Welcome to New World Newts, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, on its 10th anniversary, Harold Pinter's great Nobel Prize speech on government crimes and government lies. Part 1 this week, part 2 next, and we'll start off with a chat by me. I hope you'll stay tuned. We're at the 80th anniversary of the birth of Harold Pinter, and the 10th anniversary of his Nobel Prize for Literature. Harold Pinter was born in the borough of Hackney, in London's quite unfashionable East End. Born October 10, 1930. He became one of the most important playwrights in the English language of the 20th century. His famous plays include The Room, The Birthday Party, and The Homecoming. He also acted and directed. He also wrote screenplays for movies, including The French Lieutenant's Woman. Pinter was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2005 and the French Legion of Honor in 2007. Not bad for a lower middle class kid from Hackney. He died of cancer in 2008. Interestingly, his awards do not include a knighthood or similar title from his homeland. The lack of honors at home isn't entirely surprising. In his later years, he was a fierce critic of the British government, a fierce critic of its militarism and imperialism and hypocrisy and lies, and also its role as obedient lapdog to the greater militarists and imperialists and hypocrites and liars, the United States government, nominally headed by W. Bush. So he was never Sir Harold Pinter. No big surprise. War criminal Tony Blair, on the other hand, did get a knighthood afterwards, probably for the glorious Iraq War he brought the UK into. Pinter had to settle for the Nobel Prize and the Legion of Honor. Actually, I'm not all that familiar with Pinter's plays, but his Nobel acceptance speech was a corker, and we shall hear it on the show this week and next. Last week's show made me think of Pinter. Last week's show focused on the indefensible, unconscionable acts of aggression one's country does to other countries. It focused on the countless unjustifiable wars and smaller-scale acts of violence a country commits, mainly in order to increase the profits of its big business interests at home. In a democracy, the citizens would never allow such a wanton violation of their values and principles. So, in order to act like blood-stained imperialists, governments emit a thick smokescreen of lies, cover-ups, lies, secrecy, invented fake crises, invented fake enemies, and more lies. Last week we had Richard Saunders give a wealth of examples, and I added one of my own, the phony Iran nuclear bomb crisis, which is even phonier than the phony Iraq nuclear bomb crisis Bush invented in 2003. Meanwhile, India and Pakistan have nuclear bombs, and Israel has multiple nuclear bombs, and to their atomic stockpiles, the United States government is imitating Sergeant Schultz in Hogan's Heroes and saying, "I see nothing." Instead, we've had years of lies upon lies about the threat of, quote, a nuclear Iran, unquote. And American citizens are in danger of believing the lies on the principle that if there's this much smoke, there must be fire. Don't get me started. Harold Pinter. In his Nobel acceptance speech of 2005, he talks about just this sort of thing. He begins by contrasting truth for the artist and truth for the citizen. In a work of art, such as a Pinter play, truth is elusive, shifting, probably unknowable. On some level, perhaps truth does not really even exist. That's in a work of art. By contrast, in the world of politics, the world of the citizen, for all practical purposes, there is indeed truth, and there are also lies. The deadliest liars are governments that insist on doing the indefensible, murder and plunder abroad. They build a mountain of lies to hide their crimes from the citizens. Pinter says, since World War II, the crimes and lies of the Soviet Union have been called out and denounced by the Western powers, and rightly so. But the Western powers, too, are guilty of equally heinous crimes and lies, especially the United States. Their lies and their crimes need to be called out, too. Pinter discusses a few examples. One of his examples is Nicaragua, and let's have a quick history refresher now. Nicaragua in the Reagan-Thatcher era. At the time, most of Latin America suffered under brutal right-wing military dictatorships, trained, backed, and installed by the United States. Nicaragua overthrew its dictatorship and installed a progressive, democratic, left-leaning government, the so-called Sandinista government. So, the United States declared the Sandinistas tyrants and communists and murderers and increased funding for the real dictatorships in El Salvador and Guatemala, and remnants left in Nicaragua. The U.S. had them send in the death squads to overthrow the fledgling democracy in Nicaragua, while helping them along with economic sanctions against Nicaragua, just as they did to Chile under Salvador Allende and Venezuela ever since Hugo Chavez. The U.S. supported reactionary forces fighting to overthrow the Sandinista government of Nicaragua were called the Contras. Okay, end of history refresher. Pinter was too ill to attend the Nobel Award ceremonies in Stockholm. He videotaped his address in London, and it was played at the ceremonies. December 2005. Here is Harold Pinter on Truth in Art, Truth in Politics, and the Bloody Lies of the U.S. Government.
I'm very sorry that I can't be in Stockholm. In 1958, I wrote the following. There are no hard distinctions between what is real and what is unreal, nor between what is true and what is false. A thing is not necessarily either true or false. It can be both true and false. I believe that these assertions still make sense and do still apply to the exploration of reality through art. So, as a writer, I stand by them. But as a citizen, I cannot. As a citizen, I must ask, what is true? What is false? Truth in drama is forever elusive. You never quite find it, but the search for it is compulsive. The search is clearly what drives the endeavor. The search is your task. More often than not, you stumble upon the truth in the dark, colliding with it, or just glimpsing an image or a shape which seems to correspond to the truth, often without realizing that you have done so. But the real truth is that there never is any such thing as one truth to be found in dramatic art. There are many. These truths challenge each other, recoil from each other, reflect each other, ignore each other, tease each other, are blind to each other. Sometimes you feel you have the truth of a moment in your hand, then it slips through your fingers and is lost. It's a strange moment, the moment of creating characters who up to that moment have had no existence. What follows is fitful, uncertain, even hallucinatory, although sometimes it can be an unstoppable avalanche. the author's position is an odd one. In a sense, he is not welcomed by the characters. The characters resist him. They are not easy to live with. They are impossible to define. You certainly can't dictate to them. To a certain extent, you play a never-ending game with them. Cat and mouse, blind man's buff, hide and seek. But finally, you find that you have people of flesh and blood on your hands. People with will and an individual sensibility of their own, made out of component parts you are unable to change, manipulate, or distort. So language in art remains a highly ambiguous transaction, a quicksand, a trampoline, a frozen pool, which might give way under you, the author, at any time. But as I have said, the search for the truth can never stop. It cannot be adjourned. It cannot be postponed. It has to be faced right there on the spot. Political language, as used by politicians, does not venture into any of this territory, since the majority of politicians, on the evidence available to us, are interested not in truth, but in power, and in the maintenance of that power. To maintain that power, it is essential that people remain in ignorance, that they live in ignorance of the truth, even the truth of their own lives. What surrounds us, therefore, is a vast tapestry of lies upon which we feed. The justification for the invasion of Iraq was that Saddam Hussein possessed a highly dangerous body of weapons of mass destruction, some of which could be fired in 45 minutes, bringing about appalling devastation. We were assured that was true. It was not true. We were told that Iraq had a relationship with Al-Qaeda and shared responsibility for the atrocity in New York of September 11th, 2001. We were assured that this was true. It was not true. We were told that Iraq threatened the security of the world. We were assured it was true. It was not true. The truth is something entirely different. The truth is to do with how the United States understands its role in the world and how it chooses to embody it. But before I come back to the present, I would like to look at the recent past, by which I mean United States foreign policy since the end of the Second World War. I believe it is obligatory upon us to subject this period to at least some kind of even limited scrutiny, which is all that time will allow here. Everyone knows what happened in the Soviet Union and throughout Eastern Europe during the post-war period. The systematic brutality, the widespread atrocities, the ruthless suppression of independent thought. All this has been fully documented and verified. But my contention here is that the United States crimes in the same period have only been superficially recorded, let alone documented, let alone acknowledged, let alone recognized as crimes at all. I believe this must be addressed, and that the truth has considerable bearing on where the world stands now. Although constrained to a certain extent by the existence of the Soviet Union, the United States' actions throughout the world made it clear that it had concluded it had carte blanche to do what it liked. Direct invasion of a sovereign state has never, in fact, been America's favorite method. In the main, it has preferred what it has described as low-intensity conflict. Low-intensity conflict means that thousands of people die, but slower than if you dropped a bomb on them in one fell swoop. It means that you infect the heart of the country, that you establish a malignant growth and watch the gangrene bloom. When the populace has been subdued, or beaten to death, the same thing, and your own friends, the military, and the great corporations, sit comfortably in power, you go before the camera and say that democracy has prevailed. This was a commonplace in U.S. foreign policy in the years to which I refer. The tragedy of Nicaragua was a highly significant case. I choose to offer it here as a potent example of America's view of its role in the world, both then and now. I was present at a meeting at the U.S. Embassy in London in the late 1980s. The United States Congress was about to decide whether to give more money to the Contras in their campaign against the state of Nicaragua. I was a member of a delegation speaking on behalf of Nicaragua. But the most important member of this delegation was a Father John Metcalf. The leader of the United States body was Raymond Seitz, then number two to the ambassador, later ambassador himself. Father Metcalf said, "Sir, I am in charge of a parish in the north of Nicaragua. My parishioners built a school, a health center, a cultural center. We have lived in peace. A few months ago, a Contra force attacked the parish. They destroyed everything, the school, the health center, the cultural center. They raped nurses and teachers, slaughtered doctors in the most brutal manner. They behaved like savages. Please demand that the U.S. government withdraw its support from this shocking terrorist activity." Raymond Seitz had a very good reputation as a rational, responsible, and highly sophisticated man. He was greatly respected in diplomatic circles. He listened, paused, and then spoke with some gravity. "Father," he said, "let me tell you something. In war, innocent people always suffer." There was a frozen silence. We stared at him. He did not flinch. "Innocent people, indeed, always suffer." Finally, somebody said, "But in this case, innocent people were the victims of a gruesome atrocity subsidized by your government, one among many. If Congress allows the Contras more money, further atrocities of this kind will take place. Is this not the case? Is your government not, therefore, guilty of supporting acts of murder and destruction upon the citizens of a sovereign state?" Seitz was imperturbable. "I don't agree that the facts as presented support your assertions," he said. As we were leaving the embassy, a U.S. aide told me that he enjoyed my plays. I did not reply. I should remind you that at the time President Reagan made the following statement: "The Contras are the moral equivalent of our founding fathers." The United States supported the brutal Somoza dictatorship in Nicaragua for over 40 years. The Nicaraguan people, led by the Sandinistas, overthrew this regime in 1979, a breathtaking popular revolution. The Sandinistas weren't perfect. They possessed their fair share of arrogance, and their political philosophy contained a number of contradictory elements, but they were intelligent, rational, and civilized. They set out to establish a stable, decent, pluralistic society. The death penalty was abolished. Hundreds of thousands of poverty-stricken peasants were brought back from the dead. Over 100,000 families were given title to land. 2,000 schools were built. A quite remarkable literacy campaign reduced illiteracy in the country to less than one-seventh free education was established and a free health service. Infant mortality was reduced by a third. Polio was eradicated. The United States denounced these achievements as Marxist-Leninist subversion. In the view of the US government, a dangerous example was being set. If Nicaragua was allowed to establish basic norms of social and economic justice, if it was allowed to raise the standards of healthcare and education and achieve social unity and national self-respect, neighboring countries would ask the same questions and do the same things. There was, of course, at the time, fierce resistance to the status quo in El Salvador. I spoke earlier about a tapestry of lies which surrounds us. President Reagan commonly described Nicaragua as a totalitarian dungeon. This was taken generally by the media, and certainly by the British government, as accurate and fair comment. But there was, in fact, no record of death squads under the Sandinista government. There was no record of torture. There was no record of systematic or official military brutality. No priests were ever murdered in Nicaragua. There were, in fact, three priests in the government, two Jesuits and a Maryknoll missionary. The totalitarian dungeons were actually next door, in El Salvador and Guatemala. The United States had brought down the democratically elected government of Guatemala in 1954, and it is estimated that over 200,000 people had been victims of successive military dictatorships. Six of the most distinguished Jesuits in the world were viciously murdered at the Central American University in San Salvador in 1989 by a battalion of the Al-Cattle Regiment, trained at Fort Benning, Georgia, USA. That extremely brave man, Archbishop Romero, was assassinated while saying Mass. It is estimated that 75,000 people died. Why were they killed? They were killed because they believed a better life was possible and should be achieved. That belief immediately qualified them as communists. They died because they dared to question the status quo, the endless plateau of poverty, disease, degradation, and depression, which had been their birthright. The United States finally brought down the Sandinista government. It took some years and considerable resistance, but relentless economic persecution and 30,000 dead finally undermined the spirit of the Nicaraguan people. They were exhausted and poverty-stricken once again. The casinos moved back into the country. Free health and free education were over. Big business returned with a vengeance. Democracy had prevailed. But this policy was by no means restricted to Central America. It was conducted throughout the world. It was never ending. And it is as if it never happened. The United States supported, and in many cases engendered, every right-wing military dictatorship in the world after the end of the Second World War. I refer to Indonesia, Greece, Uruguay, Brazil, Paraguay, Haiti, Turkey, the Philippines, Guatemala, El Salvador, and of course, Chile. The horror the United States inflicted upon Chile in 1973 can never be purged and can never be forgiven. Hundreds of thousands of deaths took place throughout these countries. Did they take place? And are they, in all cases, attributable to U.S. foreign policy The answer is yes. They did take place. And they are attributable to American foreign policy. But you wouldn't know it. It never happened. Nothing ever happened. Even while it was happening, it wasn't happening. It didn't matter. It was of no interest. The crimes of the United States have been systematic, constant, vicious, remorseless, but very few people have actually talked about them. You have to hand it to America. It has exercised a quite clinical manipulation of power worldwide, while masquerading as a force for universal good. It's a brilliant, even witty, highly successful act of hypnosis. I put to you that the United States is, without doubt, the greatest show on the road. Brutal, indifferent, scornful, and ruthless it may be, but it's also very clever. As a salesman, it is out on its own, and its most saleable commodity is self-love. It's a winner. Listen to all American presidents on television say the words, "the American people." As in the sentence, "I say to the American people, it is time to pray and to defend the rights of the American people. And I ask the American people to trust their president in the action he is about to take on behalf of the American people." It's a scintillating stratagem. Language is actually employed to keep thought at bay. The words "American people" provide a truly voluptuous cushion of reassurance. You don't need to think. Just lie back on the cushion. The cushion may be suffocating your intelligence and your critical faculties, but it's very comfortable. This does not apply, of course, to the 40 million people living below the poverty line and the 2 million men and women imprisoned in the vast gulag of prisons which extends across the United States.
Here we'll pause part one of Harold Pinter's fine Nobel Prize acceptance speech of December 2005. It's the 10th anniversary of that speech and the 85th anniversary of Pinter's birth in Hackney, London. But as you can hear, there's nothing hackneyed about this speech. Part two next week. Thanks to the Nobel Prize people for the video of his talk, which I have condensed slightly. www.nobelprize.org. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. And that's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, hoping that ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. Or at least, you'll have a better understanding of what you're up against. Illegitimae non carborundum, make love not war, and please come back again next week. Ciao.